I'm Christian Corley, and with me are James McLean and Brian Terranova. You could call it the classic lineup of the podcast with a K. How are you? I hope you're well and getting through whatever is happening with you at the moment in this strange kind of this strange era which we find ourselves in at the moment. Now, we don't have anything thematic. We're just going to basically catch up with things that have been going on in the world of Doctor Who. Some cool things like tweet-alongs, funny bits of Twitter and funny comments from former doctors in the news, and also the sad news of some recent contributors to the pantheon of Doctor Who have sadly passed away and whose impact surpasses the world of the Doctor as well. First off, a quick little catch-up with my colleagues and I, because we've spoken a few minutes ago as we lined up for this, but it's been a few weeks before since we've done our podcast. So how are you guys?
You know what I mean, like as well as anybody else, I guess, through all this madness right now, you know. Could be worse.
How have you been spending your TV watching time?
So as we spoke a little bit at the beginning there, things we probably don't need to go too in-depth. It's not exactly the easiest for me to watch TV right now. So I've been listening to quite a bit of TV. And unfortunately for me, because of that, it's been mostly like a lot of daytime TV. I've been watching like old TV shows. You know, right now, to give you an idea, as we're talking, sitting on the TV muted is Chips, which I don't even know if you guys really got that over there.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right, so you know it's on. Knight Rider was on before.
We had Knight Rider on the other day.
Did you?
I had to explain it to my son. He was like, he thought it was really cool until I explained the watch, and he's like, "What?"
Well, you know, it's like I wanna watch certain things, and certain things I'm specifically waiting to watch at this point right now, and then other things I'm like, I've seen that a million times. I don't even feel like listening to that. So having all this stuff on is just kind of like, well, I haven't seen this stuff in ages. And kind of, it's, you know, what's kind of interesting, I'll be honest, given what we're in right now, it's interesting to watch TV shows from an era when things were very positive. And it's odd to think of it that way, because you always kind of think like there was always some kind of downturn somewhere. But like the characters are just straight good guys, you know, they want to do the right thing. They're always kind of winning in the end. There's never really any kind of major losses, or like what happened with the new series of Doctor Who, you know, like we're not constantly watching the Doctor be sad that people are leaving or people are dying or things like that, you know. So it's nice. It's a bit of a change that something positive is at least happening on in the background, and to see like this snapshot of what a different time was. The most bizarre thing for me, though, is watching these and knowing I was alive during this time. And all I can look at it now is think the past. But at one point, that was the present. That was what we were living in. And it was a very different time to now. And I was just sitting here a moment ago trying to find myself back in those times without thinking of it as the past. You know, it's a very weird concept. I was alive during that time. At one point, it was all there was. There was no time after it. I don't know. Bizarre thoughts that I've been left too much time to think about these past couple of weeks.
Timey-wimey philosophizing there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be honest. They're the type of thoughts that often strike me. James, anything you've been catching up with on screen?
Well, I found a show called The Walking Dead, which I'd not watched before. So I've actually been sort of slowly meandering my way through that the last couple of days, which has been quite enjoyable. I mean, I think because I have no real interest in zombies at all, it kind of, I'm just interested in the sort of the adversity of the sort of environmental adversity, which is always interesting. In fact, the fact that the zombies suddenly appear now and then is almost like a relief from the realism of people getting at each other because they're trapped with no supplies. And they come along, it's almost like the old Incredible Hulk, you know, when Bruce Banner would turn into the tall green guy in the wig, and suddenly all the tension of the seriousness of the social issue of the episode would disappear for throwing a table around for a few minutes.
Whoa, was that a wig?
Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure whether you're being joking or not, but
no, it just dyed his hair green with green spray.
No, that was a wig. It's very clearly a wig, Christian.
Okay.
I always wondered why that wig. I mean, just let him use his black hair. Why did it have to be that odd green?
I don't want to get into this because I will get very frustrated and cross. But it always annoyed me from an aesthetic point of view. Because if you want to make someone look big and muscly, you want to make their torso look big, you've got to make their head look smaller. Sticking a large thatched nest on top of his head just makes him look bigger in the head, smaller in the body. It's like, why have you done that? That just makes no sense whatsoever from any point of aesthetic view of trying to create, you know, a super being. He was terrible. It got to the movies. The hair sprouted bigger, didn't it? It got even more thatchy and bouffanty. It was really, really weird. If you watch the trailer.
Oh, it was into the 80s then, that's why.
Well, yeah, but back end of the 80s where you've got things like the Return of the Incredible Hulk and Trial of the Incredible Hulk and Death of the Incredible Hulk.
And the shoulder pads on him as well. Whoa.
The shoulder pads of the Incredible Hulk.
And the slippers, because they're always fun to watch in the series. When you actually, if you catch the long shots, you'd see him wearing the slippers as he ran down Fifth Avenue or wherever. Anyway, so yeah, The Walking Dead I've been watching. Something I have been enjoying, and I think we'll probably, this will probably segue a bit into what we're going to be talking about, is some of those sort of like unusual show moments which wouldn't exist if you didn't have this situation. Whose Line Is It Anyway, which I've loved for many, many years. They've been doing over the last 3 weeks before each episode, new episode airs, which they filmed before the pandemic. They're getting online onto YouTube and they're just chatting for about an hour.
All right.
And so you get the mixture of seeing the people talking about the show, chatting amongst themselves, and because they're all middle-aged, really struggling with Zoom, every week someone, Ryan Stiles is a technophobe, so you've always got these sort of problems. And so there's a weird sort of like pop bubbles of entertainment, which is sort of just sort of pop out of the bath or the metaphorical water, whatever we're talking about here. They're just sort of there for a moment, which is just nice to capture. And they just give, not only are they just a little different, but they're also a reminder of how united we all are across the globe in this situation and how we're all at every level sort of trying to come to terms and reconcile and work through it. And yeah, this is the way that they've been trying to work through it. And CW allegedly gives them very little publicity, so it's a nice way for them to try and publicize their show as well. But it's interesting seeing them enjoying a medium which they're not used to working on as well. So I enjoyed that. I've been watching those each week. John Oliver's back, which is fascinating, watching the late-nighters work from home with remote teams. Again, it's another fascinating insight. You know, this being a moment of history where we're seeing this massive weird adaptation within the media industry within 3-4 weeks, and suddenly it's all so totally changing.
Yeah. The strange thing about it as well is that kind of whole new studio aesthetic is now living rooms and offices.
Yeah.
And all those people are doing basically anyone can spoof it now because you don't have to have that polished backdrop. You don't have the green backdrop or, you know, the polished IKEA sofas and everything around. You can just do it in any living room and either spoof it or just do the real thing.
Absolutely. And so you've got John Oliver, who spent a few days apparently sort of working with his production team, so he actually records it in his own home with their help and support. So, you know, it's like a one-man show, and seeing them sort of work through these is very interesting. A show which wasn't hit by the coronavirus was The Red Dwarf, which I watched last week.
Right.
So that's something else which, you know, it's now, what, 31 years old or so? Yeah. It's quite interesting to see them try and do a sort of like a movie format, 2 45-minute episodes back-to-back. So that, again, was something to watch. So there's been loads of things to watch, lots of interesting things. Watched a few Doctor Who's recently. Watched a couple of Matt Smith's, because not an era I particularly are fond of. And I have to admit, again, segueing to what we'll be talking about, that was sort of nurtured by, you know, Stephen Moffat and Russell T Davis doing these sort of tweet-a-thon Global Watches. And I didn't watch it with them because I've no interest in being partaking in any sort of form of fan community. So I'd wait for a 2 days later, then I would watch it myself in my own sullen, grumpy home. And that's been quite interesting as well. So, yeah, it's a weird time. The future is disconcerting for many reasons, as we were talking about before this podcast started. But the actual time itself, if you can get past the sort of whatever your situation is, I've found it quite interesting.
I think the internet has helped a lot, hasn't it? I mean, it's hindered in many ways, but in terms of things that people have been doing online, largely creators, it has been a help to make things a little more bearable, I think, for a lot of people. As we record this, there has just finished a Life on Mars tweet thing with Matthew Graham and Ashley Farrow. These things are going on all over the place. Doctor Who, I mean, Doctor Who's trending on a weekly basis on Twitter, which is like absolutely amazing, because it's not people whinging over audience figures or whatever from season 12. It's like people excitedly talking about, like, yesterday or the day before, it was Heaven Sent, which loads of Twitter attention to that. These have been taking place regularly, so obviously that was with Stephen Moffat tweeting. Coming up on Sunday, which is why I'm going to mention this one specifically, there's a global rewatch of The Stolen Earth and Journey's End with live tweets from Russell T. Davies and Graham Harper.
There's a Torchwood one, isn't there, on Friday? Is it Torchwood?
I think there's a Torchwood one coming up as well. And there's kind of a lot of people are keen to get the key members of the cast involved with the Doctor Who one on Sunday as well. But yeah, there's a Torchwood one. I think there's a Sarah Jane Adventures one as well being planned. And there's been Doctor Who ones going on. So the best thing to do is to head onto Twitter to find out what's going on with that. They're also mentioned on Facebook. The DWM tweet is probably the best place to catch up with what's going on there with those. But you can also find Emily Cook on Twitter, who seems to be organising most of these events. But they're a lot of fun, and depends how you feel about online communities. If you're on the same page as James, maybe just dip into them later on and watch them in your own time.
Well, they are actually, to be fair to them, snark aside, as you say, if you actually look through the Twitter replies, 95% of them are actually really positive, engaging.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you'll get the one person who'll go, "Oh, Moffat, come back. I can't stand Jodie," or something. And you just think, don't.
Why are you here?
Why are you here? You know, he doesn't want to hear that. I'm sure he doesn't believe that. And that's not what they're there for. So it seems you get that with everywhere. So, but those are very minimal. It's not, as you say, that sort of very antagonistic, snipey world. These are very sort of positive, well contributed events. And I think maybe part of it is as we say, you know, because it's like a global thing, everyone is sort of almost like leveled, and that hierarchy of, you know, this person is ruining my show sort of disappears a bit, and it's almost like we're all interested in this show because you've got Stephen Moffat or Russell T. Davies talking about the show and watching it along with you. So, you know, they are as much a participant in the event as they are someone with capital in it. So, I think they're really good. And Doctor Who, I think, is perhaps worth saying is, you know, it's a very nice bit of comfort material. I know, like Brian was saying, you know, the new series has had a lot more sort of introspective drama involved in it, but certainly on a rewatch that stuff isn't quite so downy, I think, because you know that the next episode or the next season is going to move on onto new things, so you watch it for what it is.
And I should say that was just one of the first things that came to my mind when I was talking about that. I think Doctor Who does it well, and I think one of the things about Doctor Who that it always did well for me, and I was actually just talking about this recently, was it does spread positivity and it does show people how to live a better life. It's like it's what the Doctor does, you know, picks up humans or aliens or whomever to travel with him, and whoever he helps in the episode, he kind of shows them how to live a better life, he or she, how to live a better life. And I think that's one of the great things about the show. It was just when talking about tonal things, I guess my thought process was more so that kind of aspect of storytelling even made its way into Doctor Who.
Yeah, you're talking about sort of a modern day approach to storytelling compared to the sort of more syndicated, simplistic procedural approach that you'd have in, say, Chips or Knight Rider.
But it is amazing that these little tweet-alongs and so on, you know, they are bringing together a lot of people at a time when it's really necessary. And like you said, you'll get like the odd few tweets there, I'm sure. I haven't really partaken in too many of them, but I've read a couple of replies from the people involved and so on. But even like bands like They Might Be Giants, you know, they streamed a live concert of theirs to help kind of ease the tension. So there's a lot of this going on, and it's a really fun thing. But it is great to just have that outlet. Just being able to tweet along with a million people that you don't know, you know, it's such a cool idea. It's a fun thing. And I wonder if it's going to be something that somehow will in some way be kept up when life kind of returns back to some kind of normalcy.
Elizabeth Morton, a lady who's a successful writer and former actress, recently tweeted this little tune.
Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday, dear Peter.
The discerning among you may have spotted the voice of Peter Davison there, Mr. Elizabeth Morton, singing himself some birthday wishes, which he shared on Twitter, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. And there's, if you check that out in the show notes, their dog Stanley is also trying to get in on the action. Now, the reason I shared that, because it's a little bit twee for me, isn't it? I don't normally share stuff like that, but, you know, it's the time that we're in. Basically, I like it. I love the self-deprecating humour of Peter Davison. He didn't do enough comedy, frankly.
No.
It would be very interesting to see his era if they allowed him to have a comedic tone in there somewhere rather than completely strip him of it.
I mean, he did do comedies, but laterally in his career, he didn't. He did like a few comedies around the same time. Obviously, there was All Creatures Great and Small, which is... I mean, what is it? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? It's certainly somewhere in there. And then there's Sink or Swim and Very Peculiar Practice. But it then sort of tailed off and he just started doing like detective dramas and guest appearances and things. And James?
Don't forget the Five Doctors or the Five Fish Doctors or whatever.
Five Fish Doctors. Yeah, that's something they should be doing on this tweet-a-thon thing. Because that is a really brilliant piece of work.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a good example of not just, like you're saying, some of the sitcoms he did and All Creatures as well, where he is playing comedy, but you've got something where he's actually involved in the creation side of it as well. And of course, also got to say, you know, with him doing singing, we've got Button Moon as well.
Now, someone the other day, I don't know if I'll be able to dig this out because it was a few days ago and... If I click like on Twitter, it happens quite often, either intentionally or intentionally, unintentionally or unintentionally, and you end up with this great list of things that you've liked, and then you go back through it. Because I kind of use the like button as a sort of bookmark, which I know you're not supposed to do.
Because it's
I know! Anyway, someone shared a picture of this kind of 7-foot-tall Mr. Spoon, basically. And it was a scary-looking thing. Obviously, the real thing wasn't quite as big as that, but... You wouldn't have wanted to bump into Mr. Spoon.
Something I noticed in this period, I've been watching, say, because I started watching Red Dwarf from the beginning because I knew they were doing this special. Oh. I thought, oh, I'll give this a go. I haven't watched it in years. And by and large, it holds up pretty well, given it's 31 years. And it hasn't aged uncomfortably like some shows do. There's a couple of shows with maybe some what now would be considered questionable sort of ideologies, but by and large it was pretty good. And I got to it was about the fifth season, I think it's Angels and Devils, I can't remember, but there was always that thing about the TARDIS being made by the effects crew and being positioned by Starbug launches. And I hadn't realized until I watched it that it's actually one shot in the show where you do actually see it. What I remember originally reading is that it's actually it was a wide shot, and of course being on the 4:3 at the time ratio, it didn't actually get into that shot.
Right.
But there is actually a shot where you can actually see it. So, you know, in terms of crossovers, they're just a small thing. And it's one of those little moments of watching far too much television and you sort of pick something new out of that rewatch. Of, ah, Police Box is actually there.
Seventh Doctor and Ace wandering around somewhere.
Could have been, yeah.
That fast absolutely. Spacecraft, yeah.
Something else I've watched, actually, which we'll put in the show notes. It was done 2 years ago. I've not seen it before, but it's got... it's one of those... you remember there was a while ago, there was the question montage video that was on YouTube.
The question?
What was the line? I can't even remember what it's...
this Doctor Who?
Yeah, Doctor Who.
Right, okay.
Just that refers to the Stephen Moffat era's last question. I can't remember what it's... There was another one very similar to that. It's 20 minutes long. And it's someone who's just done a very nice montage of Doctor Who, which is sort of slightly woven together topically of the whole series with little shots and moments from the whole series. And it's just a really not, again, because there's no pressing concerns of having to be anywhere. I watched the 20 minutes and it's a really nice little reminder of what makes Doctor Who cool. And as I say, it's got everything from every era just dropped in stylistically all over the place. So it's not chronological. It's just sort of almost like topical, but very loosely topical.
Right. Yeah, so share
first
that.
First question, isn't it? The first question.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, just going back to that, because I forgot something else I was going to mention earlier. There was a live tweet along of the Doctor's wife the other night, and there's this fantastic little YouTube video of Arthur Darvill in character in 1940, whatever, as Rory, with Karen Gillan shouting at him from off camera as Amy. And it was really, really well done. Nicely written, well presented as a smartphone recording. And then you got Karen Gillan involved as well. It was really good.
That was Neil Gaiman writing that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we've also got, there's been those short stories, which some of them are old ones, which have been put back up. The BBC website, was it radio? No, it's BBC website, isn't it? It's been showcasing. There was the umpty-ums that Stephen Moffat wrote. The silence. You've not read them.
The umpty-ums.
The umpty-ums. There'll be people listening to this going, "Why is Christian Corley and Brian Terranova doing this podcast?" If they didn't.
Well, the umpty-ums.
It's a short story that Stephen Moffat's done, and it's been.
Why I didn't read it.
It's a story related to Jodie Whittaker's Doctor, so it's a brand new thing.
Right. No, yes, I didn't know that was what it was called.
Yeah.
So, to be honest, I don't read any kind of Doctor Who fiction or any kind of fiction. Period. I don't really like fiction books. Kind of odd to say that. I prefer my books to be kind of like factual kind of stuff, like behind the scenes, how stuff was made. I like my fiction to be kind of movie or TV format. Odd quirk about me, but there you go. That would be why I don't read this stuff.
Yeah. I
like chocolate, but I also like carrots.
Fiction as well, but I would probably say I read about 50-50, and I don't tend to read Doctor Who stories very often.
Any time I've ever read a Doctor Who book, I felt that it was anything but Doctor Who. I felt that the writers didn't capture the characters or the era or the stories or the feel of the show that I liked. I've never gotten into it. So I've just stayed away from it.
Okay, right. So for anyone else other than these two grumpy old bores, if you want to read these, because there's a new one that's just gone up by Paul Cornell called The Shadow Passes. The Terror of the Umpty-Ums by Stephen Moffat. Pete McTighe's done a very sort of meta story called Press Play. Obviously Rose's the prequel to Rose that Russell T. Davies unearthed, which he mentioned in his tweet-a-thon, I think, for Rose. That's up there as well. We'll put the link in the show notes, obviously. And they're worth a look if you are interested in reading short stories of Doctor Who.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're not, that's fine. There's nothing. I'm not knocking either of you for it. I'm a little surprised.
Well,
disappointed maybe.
Oh, he's disappointed, isn't he? Really? We all know that. Okay, let's move on. There's something I desperately want to share with you about this that I'm inspired by with this next story, but I'm going to do my best to keep my lid on it for the time being because it might not happen. But anyway, it's nothing to do with the person that I'm about to talk about. It's just something very vaguely related to what I'm about to say. Chris Eccleston thinks it's inevitable that he'll catch coronavirus, and as a result, he's cut down on his, quote, drinking as he prepares to catch coronavirus, which sounds like quite a selfless act to me. That he's going to put himself forward to catch the virus. Joking aside, though, I mean, I think it is a sensible thing to do. I do believe the World Health Organization, for whatever you might think of them at the moment, recently issued a diktat or directive, whatever you want to call it, suggesting people cut down on their drinking whilst they're stuck at home, because it could make matters worse. And then there's the whole alcohol-related issues of drinking too much anyway. But Eccleston says, I'm thinking if I can protect my immune system, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get COVID-19, he began. I think we all have to think it will happen, but my aim is to be able to handle it without going to hospital. So as a reasonably fit 56-year-old bloke, if I can keep myself away from the NHS, if someone older, for instance, my mum, needed a bed, then they would get the bed. And, you know, it's there is something slightly silly about the way the headline is presented, but to be honest with you, you can't really fault his logic, can you?
No, I'm very much the same. I'm not drinking. Same thing, to try and keep my immunity up. So same sort of rationale as well. And obviously a self-centered rationale of try and make sure that I'm you know, in good health.
Yeah.
But I can understand it. And I think it's, as you say, I think the problem is the way that it's been written up sort of takes away the actual quite solid message, which perhaps people hadn't thought about, because, you know, it's quite natural not to think about it, that, you know, if you get ill, you might be taking up the space of someone else who might need it more. So that's a really nice idea to sort of ideology to be putting forward. And the sort of, you say, the headlines, I excited for the headlines and read the article. You don't really get that being the point. No, good on him.
Yeah.
We're always going to sell headlines in the best way to attract readers, and usually it's the negative spin. Mm,
absolutely.
You know, obviously.
Yeah, sadly. Now, listen, we did mention about what the guys have been watching individually on during their downtime, enforced or otherwise. I've been watching a whole range of things, from episodes of Time Team on YouTube, which I think I mentioned before, but now there's a Time Team YouTube channel that uploads nice crisp versions of the episodes rather than pirated VHS versions. And but I've also signed up to BritBox a few weeks ago. We've also got a Disney Plus subscription, but I don't want to talk about that at the moment. And on BritBox, we have got 26 years of Doctor Who to watch, which is really, really cool. I've been watching Planet of Evil, which has not been one of my favourites historically, and enjoying it in a way that I never have before, really. So that's been nice. Watching it. Also, I've been watching it in a kind of episodic format rather than trying to binge it as you would on a VHS. So yeah, that's maybe helped as well.
I like Planet of Evil. I think one of the main things I like about it is they actually created an entire alien landscape, and
yes,
I like that. You don't nowadays when you get an alien landscape, it usually just looks like Earth in some form.
Yeah, there's definitely advantages to it from a technical point of view. It is accomplished in that sense. There's certain things about it I don't like that annoy me. Some of the guest cast, maybe the form of the story as well, but visually it looks, in terms of the set, it is good.
It's too slow. It needed to be three parts maximum. And so, yeah, that's my issue with it. But I do agree with Brian. It does have an aesthetic which is memorable and works.
Is that the biggest part Prentice Hancock has in Doctor Who? I think it is, because he's in I always remember, I mean, obviously he's in, I mean, I think he's in Spearhead from Space, isn't he, briefly? Is he one of the journalists in Spearhead from Space?
Not sh-
He's in an early 30 one that I can think of, and he's also in the Ribos operation, isn't he? But he doesn't really do much in the Ribos operation. He's just, you know, that wrapped up guard guy, isn't he?
Yes.
But he's that kind of very distinct face that he has, and he also always manages to bring something slightly different.
Yes, he's one of the he's Jimmy, the journalist in Spearhead from Space.
So so I've been watching that. I think I'm up to episode 4 of that now. But BritBox is good for old stuff, but it's frustrating. It's very difficult to get to the specific episode that you actually want to go to, which is a bit of a pain. But there's plenty of good stuff on there. I'd recommend it.
There's other places to be thinking about. I mean, Big Finish recently did. They've done a couple of free downloads.
Yes.
They did. Most recently, they did The Beginning, which I already had, Companion Chronicles, which tells the very first, the first stories of Susan Foreman and the Doctor. Before that, they did the Maltese Falcon, Penguin, Maltese Penguin, obviously. And they've done some good deals there. So again, if you're looking for material, and they're, you know, a fine company that's worth supporting, go to their website, go onto their mailing list, and make sure that you're aware of what they're up to. That could be a way to fill some time.
I'm interested with since you bring them up and what they're doing with the free giveaways, which is brilliant that everybody's helping out in that way. And I agree with you, Big Finish, definitely a wonderful company to back. They are posting photos of basically a bunch of the actors and directors and so on doing like Zoom meetings, but where they're actually recording the dramas that they have planned. And it's like, it's neat. It's an interesting thought. And like with technology today, recording technology and everything so on, you know, being as advanced, maybe it can work. But I do wonder if there's going to be a noticeable quality difference with everybody recording their parts from their own home rather than in a studio with controlled environment.
Could be.
I'm real curious to see how that's going to go, because even and it should be said, even when they do record in studio, there's sometimes variances in quality. I mean, I remember a couple of plays where it sounded like Paul McGann or even Sylvester McCoy were like phoned in. And I don't mean the acting. They're always top notch. I mean, like the quality of the recording, it sounded noticeably different than the other actors, which, you know, once you get into the story, you don't even like really think about that. But when you first hear it, it's a little jarring. And I wonder what was going on there. I wonder if it was just like an odd recording, or if maybe they actually did do some kind of remote recording at some point. But I just found it interesting since you brought them up. It was something I was thinking about with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something that's going to become people haven't been thinking that much about, but is becoming more and more aware that obviously this sort of thing crushes and slows down productions and will kill shows as well. And how do companies navigate around this? You know, how do they navigate around making sure they can continue to perform, continue to keep bringing in money? And yeah, that's going to be one of the big hits, I think, is that we'll probably lose a lot of shows potentially.
Prepare for more repeats on television.
Absolutely, which I think is fine. Like you said, I'm amazed that, you know, a few months ago, well, for years, I've been very pleased that I had Ashes to Ashes on DVD, because it's been very hard to see anywhere else. And now, you know, BBC iPlayer has been running it. I see Ashes to Ashes is now on Prime. It's also on Netflix as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, suddenly it's just everywhere. And for a while, it was like it was a box set, which you could no longer get for a reasonable price. And suddenly that's everywhere. But again, Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes are always quite good rewatches if there's something to, you know, you desire something new to watch, or something old new to watch, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you know, definitely. Sad, you actually can't get Ashes to Ashes on any kind of like home media over here, to my knowledge. I know you can get Life on Mars. I have that, but I haven't been able to get Ashes to Ashes here.
It's oddly defunct in production, I'm sure. I was looking on Amazon and it's like there's no copies of it. So anyway, but yeah, so in the UK anyway, Ashes to Ashes is now everywhere. So if you haven't seen it in a while, or I've not seen it at all, watch it while it's there before it disappears again.
Yeah, definitely. That's an unfortunate segue.
Go on.
Because that does bring us to news of recent departures.
Ashes to Ashes, okay.
Well, no, disappearing again, but also Ashes to Ashes, yeah, I guess. Several people have passed away recently, which we should all address in turn. I think we'd probably start with Honor Blackman, who appeared in Doctor Who in 1986 in the Trial of a Time Lord serial Terror of the Vervoids, but she was actually more well known as being possibly the most unique Bond girl, and also for the Avengers as Kathy Gale. So and that was an interesting piece of casting, because she was nearly 40 when they cast her, and they basically didn't touch any of the lines. She was cast to replace a male actor, and they didn't change any of the lines. That kind of helped develop the character considerably.
That's scary.
It really should do. So that's a wonderful thing to hear. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking, it's scary that just shows you the difference in how people write genders.
Yeah.
There is to that level. Yeah.
I think it probably depends on the actress concerned, but there's probably many actresses who couldn't have conveyed it the way she did. But and obviously the shape of the show changed after her casting as well. But and she was great in Doctor Who as well, in that Terror of the Vervoids, which, you know, it's for all the kind of pasta-like face of the Vervoids and everything else, the actual trial taking place interspersed throughout, there is a certain coziness about that episode with the lighting and the padded suits of the crew and everything. But then again, you got quite some serious stuff going on in the background with the actual creatures, the what they're actually trying to accomplish with growing them, and then the charge of genocide at the end there. It's a strange one, and written by Pip and Jane Baker, and sadly Pip Baker has passed away this week as well. Now they are writers who we've had a pop out a few times on the podcast with a K over the years, which is possibly not entirely fair, because they had very long and kind of in terms of television, you know, they had a good 40-year career, which is, you know, that's not difficult, that's not easy. 39 years active, 1961 to 2000 as television and movie writers. That's far longer than the average television writer's career, isn't it? So they must have been doing something right.
Yeah. I mean, and with Doctor Who, I mean, Terror of the Vervoids is a very enjoyable, quite generic, intentionally generic in a lot of its conventions, but is a good show, good story. Mark of the Rani has problems, but ultimately it's quite a confident piece. Feels quite solid, a bit like Planet of Earth, Planet of Evil in a lot of ways.
It is in some ways, yeah. And it's better than Time of the Rani. And I think with Ultimate Foe as well, they basically took a vague idea that they'd heard sort of second or third hand and didn't have the episode before it, and managed to finish the series with it.
Oddly enough, Ultimate Foe feels almost like a little ahead of its time. There's I don't want to say postmodern, but there's something where it's the audience is sort of kind of, you need to be aware of media to know what it's kind of doing, and it feels sort of out of place, because it's almost sort of talking, you know, it's almost about writing itself, and, you know, this whole idea of authorship in there, and of what is fiction, what is real. And it feels very out of place with Doctor Who at its time. Well, now it would probably feel a little less odd. So I think it felt quite jarring, given what had been coming before it, which was fairly standard stuff. But then Time of the Rani has a lot of problems. And if I'm careful that we don't end up sort of... There's one thing I always hate with obituaries, is that you end up almost like rewriting the history to honor the person, but in a sense, by honoring the person, you create a caricature of that person. And I don't know Pip or Jane Baker, so I'm not saying of that level, but Time of the Rani is bad. Yeah. And it's not there, it's not solely the fault of the writing, I think is my point, but there is problems with the story there. And it's unfortunately the beginning of an era, so it's very memorable as well. So it doesn't just sort of disappear like other stories which aren't the beginning of an era and are crisply forgotten about.
however. On the flip side of that too, though, they did create the Rani, and every time somebody talks about like a new actor or actress being cast, absolutely. You know, it's the Rani. It's got to be the Rani. So like, they made a character that has created a lasting impression that people still want to see back in the show today. I'm one of them. I'd love to see the Rani come back. And I do wish it had happened sooner, even though it hasn't happened at all yet. So that's something. And you know, there could be something to be said to, I think we've spoke about this many times before in the podcast, my own personal feelings anyway, that when Stephen Moffat wrote in Russell T. Davis's era, man, was he like the strongest writer they had. But when he got his own era, he had a little bit too much creative control. Again, in my opinion, that kind of dampened my interest in the show, made for a lot of, as you said with Mark of the Rani, made for a lot of stories that just didn't work for me. And kind of like what you were saying in the beginning, watching some of the Smith era, because you're not super fond of that. That's exactly how I am. But it's an interesting thing. It makes me wonder, was Mark of the Rani and Time in the Rani kind of really down to Pip and Jane, or was it due to somebody like John Nathan Turner above them making changes that he shouldn't have been making? You know, we know he made a lot of bad judgment calls. Just look at Colin's outfit. You know, he made plenty of them, and we'll never know. But it's something to think about. Something I'd be curious to know the answer to. But unfortunately, the answers may have just left this world, and we may never have them.
We'll move on. David Collins has passed away as well.
Yeah, David Collins. He's Robots of Death.
Oh, he's in Robots of Death.
Robots of Death.
But not, Blake Seven as well, we should remember. Yeah. He's in another Doctor as well, isn't he? Something else springs to mind, and I can't think what it is.
He did one of the Unbound, didn't he?
Yeah, he's done Big Finish stuff.
Yeah. Is he in Revenge of the Seven?
My brain's... Yes, he is. He's one of the...
Oh, and of course,
oh my God, Mordrin Undead.
Mordrin Undead, yes. Yeah. I knew he'd been in more than one. Yeah, so quite a prolific part of Doctor Who.
That's right, I forgot about him with that makeup on his head.
Yes.
Wow. Makeup and not on blancmange.
I mean, I loved him in Robots of Death. I always felt very disappointed.
He's marvellous in... Yeah, he's marvellous.
You don't really get to know what happens to him unless you sort of follow Chris Boucher's books after Corpus Mark and the like, where I think that he's referred to. But in Robots of Death, you know, his last you see him is sort of under a table still. And it's just like, it's one of those last threads. As a kid, when I remember watching Robots of Death, I wanted to see resolved because I liked him. He was a really charming character in it.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, he was... regularly turned up in Sapphire and Steel as well.
Yes, as Silver. He's a very charming actor. You know, people often say he'd made a great Doctor as well, which I think is the one article. Is that on one of the articles that you put as well?
I think he probably is. Yeah.
But yeah, I remember he was always one that was. So people said, you know, in that sort of era, it was either David Collings or David Dixon from Hitchhikers. The people would go sort of,
I hadn't heard about David Dixon before. That's interesting. I can see David Collins, though. Yeah, I could see them both.
Well, I mean, Dave, to be fair, I mean, in the first few episodes of Hitchhikers, Ford Prefect by Dixon is pretty much a Doctor, isn't he? He's got that sort of eccentricity and smile and flashy eyes of the sort of Tom Baker.
Alien guide into space, yeah.
Exactly. So you can see why people would naturally incline to go, he'd make a great Doctor. I'm sure he would have, but anyway.
Also, a good point here again to talk about those interested in checking out Big Finish. If you love Robots of Death, which is, I think we can all agree here, is one of like the most enjoyable kind of classic episodes. It's a damn good story. Big Finish did a Seventh Doctor story called Robophobia, which dealt with Caldor City, or at least the robots of Caldor City. And there's another story that takes place with one of the same characters from that one called Livchenka during the Eighth Doctor's era. And unfortunately, I'm trying to remember if it's during Doom Coalition or Ravenous, but they go back to actual Caldor City and deal with that. And then she has her own spin-off radio drama series, which that one I will admit I haven't heard yet, all about the robots, though. But Robophobia is excellent. And I also really very much enjoyed the Eighth Doctor story as well. And unfortunately, the name's just not coming to me because sometimes, as they can do with audio, they blend together after a little while because there's so much to listen to.
That's the old story age, Brian.
Because my old age is creeping in and my memory isn't what it once was, Christian, my son. I can get the name. I'll get it. I'll shout it out during the next segment when it has no relevance whatsoever. I'll throw it at you.
Well, also recently passed is James Garbutt, who was 94, and he played Ronson in Genesis of the Daleks and was Doctor Who's 10th oldest living actor before he passed away.
I just read that fact, and I was, first of all, I'm surprised that there are statistics like that. I mean, I shouldn't be, but when I read it, I was like, my God, really? We're breaking it down to that now. Yeah. Interesting, though, to find out.
It is strange. Well, actually, someone has, quote, unquote, kindly provided a list of Doctor Who's oldest living actors. Earl Cameron is still with us, and he was born in 1917. William Russell is the fourth oldest surviving actor from Doctor Who. He was born in 1924. I'm going to leave it there because it's a little bit...
Yes.
Yeah. It is. It's a little bit the Deadpool, isn't it? So yeah, let's leave that there. But it's very sad that he's passed away. I think so. Many years ago, we had John Guiler, the voice actor, on the podcast. Okay, and he mentioned this line from Genesis of the Daleks, which I think is Ronson, who's protesting Davros's plan of automating the Daleks. And it's something like, "This is insane, or you're insane, Davros." But audibly, it sounds like shoes are insane.
That's great. Yeah. There's another one. I have to say it. There's another one during the Second Doctor's era, and I want to say it's which story is it? The Seeds of Death. I believe, where he says he's trying to turn on the sectional air supply. But I swear to God, it says turn on the sexual air supply.
Is this the doctor?
Turn on the sexual air supply. every time I hear it, that's all I can hear. And I'm like, what is he trying to say? And it took me forever before I realized the word was sectional.
But was it, though?
Okay, yeah, good point. With him, you don't
know. You don't know. Yeah, absolutely.
I know what Brian's Forgotten Big Finish play is called.
Go on, say it.
Put him out of his misery.
No, I'm going to leave it a little longer.
No, I've got it too. I've been waiting for the appropriate place to break in. I just didn't think another death was it, really. But go on, James.
Escape from Kaldor.
That's the one.
Oh, there you go.
And it was during Ravenous.
It was Ravenous 2.
Oh, yeah. I got a fool, man. Seriously, if you're looking for some good Big Finish recommendations, seriously. I mean, first of all, you can't go wrong with any... I want to say about 95% of the Eighth Doctor ones. There's one or two that are kind of okay for me. But when those box sets start with Dark Eyes, they just hit the ground and they never stop running. They're so good.
I probably should have continued listening after Dark Eyes. I was largely amazed at exactly how good they were. I didn't really think they could get any better because they were on a seriously different level to any of the other Doctor Who that I'd listened to from Big Finish.
Yeah, they're killing it with the Eighth Doctor stories, in my opinion. They really are. They're doing such a great job. And I'll admit, because Big Finish's output is so great, I had to make the call for my own finances and everything. Like, I had to cut some of them out because it just doesn't make sense. So I selectively purchase other dramas. I can certainly speak very highly of the War Master dramas. Certainly the first and the last box set, I will say. Maybe the first, third, and last. But there's so much that they put out. I've decided to kind of dedicate myself primarily to the Eighth Doctor, the War Doctor, the War Master, and so on. But I'm just loving what they're doing with the Eighth Doctor. I honestly wish it was Doctor Who on TV right now. And that's not a jab at anybody running the show or anything like that. I just feel like this era is speaking so greatly to me. They're so good. They're that good that they should be on the TV. I would love to see them.
Well, you know, Doctor Who is so many different things to so many different people, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there are people who don't like the Hinchcliffe era as much as they would like maybe the first, the second phase of the JNT era with the Fifth Doctor, for example. Sure. I would say it's the other way around, but, you know, and then there's people who prefer the Seventh Doctor, there's people who prefer the Ninth Doctor.
Look, between me and Gareth, I love the last season of Tom Baker's. He's a massive Graham Williams fan.
Yeah, totally.
And I have friends who adore the Matt Smith era, like through and through. And that's fair. That's one of the beautiful things about this show, is that it seems like there's an era for everybody. And if there isn't one for you yet, trust me, it's coming, kind of thing with this show.
I think there's also a beautiful thing with anything that you are interested in. So we've made the analogy before of football teams. You know, you support your team just irrespective of the manager, even though you think one manager is better than the other, one season's better than another. There's something really nice to actually be able to go back and watch stuff, as I say, where you don't have the expectations. You no longer feel like the king on the throne having the performance played before them that you then judge, which is what obviously we, in a nicest way, is what we always have to do when we do these podcasts. It's kind of what you're doing. So it's nice to go back to the 11th Hour, which was one at the time I was quite disappointed by. I didn't like Matt Smith's performance in the first scenes. Came back this time, I actually liked his performance in the first scenes. I actually quite liked a lot of the writing in it. There were some bits I didn't still like. I won't pretend that it was ever my favourite era, because I never felt that it was cohesive enough and it felt like it was always going in different directions. But I can't pretend that, you know, Stephen Moffat writes some really sharp lines and has some very clever ideas. I watched, you know, the Angels two-parter in that season. And again, there's some really good stuff in there. Couldn't bring myself. Yeah. At the same time, the one I liked at the time, The Beast Below, I quite thought that was quite good. Had no interest in watching it this time. Vampires of Venice, to me, was still bad. I still didn't enjoy it. But it gives you that ability to go back and sort of watch it through new eyes. It's that whole sort of idea that whenever you watch a show, you never watch it. I think we said this the other week. You're never watching it the same each time. Each time you watch it, you're watching a different show, in fact. You're picking something else up. You're thinking about it in a different way. You're picking up different bits, marks, moments.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting. So when you've got so many years of Doctor Who to go through, it can be a really good time, this, to sort of get away from the oppressiveness of the news and reality, which is unfortunately oppressive. No matter how you want to spin it, it's not a great time for people. And try and sort of find some, you know, mental health within watching some of this great stuff. Big Finish, Dan Dare, their Dan Dare stuff's actually pretty good. If you want to get a break from Doctor Who and you want to go through any of their other range, their Dan Dare stuff is really nice. I'm not a massive fan of Dan Dare personally, apart from
Never listened to it. My dad's a big Dan Dare fan, and he's got a lot of the reprinted collections going back to the 80s when they first started reprinting them on huge, sort of, because the original Eagle comics were very, very large. They were sort of almost A3 size, and they reprinted these, reproduced them on very glossy, high quality paper with very nice ink. And maybe it wasn't remastered to the way that it could be now, but the end result was very good. So, yeah, I've been a bit of a fan of his. And I mentioned this because I happen to know that there is an auction coming up in the next week. I think it's Thursday next week. So that'll be the 23rd, 24th, of some Dan Dare memorabilia toys from the 50s and early 60s at Vectis, which usually takes place near me. The Vectis, the main Vectis auction house, is a few miles from me, but it's purely online. So anyone can basically register and get in to put some bids in, which for retro toys like that, that's kind of big if you're a Dan Dare fan.
Yeah, nice. So yeah, if you're interested in Dan Dare, and it's not quite like those old 50s ones, which for obvious reasons is a sort of added sort of slightly deeper subtext to a lot of the stuff they're doing, you know, it's modern day storytelling, but they're still pretty good. And it's kind of nice if you're looking at supporting Big Finish to sometimes sort of try and break out of their main catalogue and support some of the sort of smaller ones and the people involved in those. Blake Seven Range is very good, some good stuff in there.
I tell you what, the show notes this week is going to be massive, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's going to be
is.
Like a supermarket receipt during lockdown.
Well, here we go.
I think it's probably a good time to wrap things up as well, to be honest with you. You've managed to squeeze an hour out of us, dear listener, and it's been enjoyable every minute of the way. For those of you who follow us on Facebook, thank you for your continued support, and to all listeners as well. But we've got some things planned which require schedules to be aligned and people to be okay to talk to us. So hopefully something will come of that, and we'll have more information and news in the coming weeks, hopefully. Until then, stay well, stay fit, and we'll see you next time. It's goodbye from us.